You are listening to the Gay Florida Man Podcast. This podcast is hosted by retired corrections officer Mark DeWolf, who will discuss various topics prevalent to corrections, gay culture, arts and entertainment, as well as current events. Listeners need to be advised that this podcast will discuss situations involving extreme violence, substance abuse, sexual assault, and murder. Details of actual events have been modified so as to protect the privacy of involved parties.
Welcome back to the Gay Florida Man. This is episode 31, and welcome to November. Hopefully you're following us on social media, because we do have a Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter page for the Gay Florida Man podcast, where we give you different insights and some pictures to go along with the podcast, as well as the YouTube page. We've been talking about all the different aspects of the prison for months now, and people don't understand that the prison is actually only half of the department. The other half is the responsibilities of supervising those people that the court decided to put on probation, or those people that are going to get released from prison. And there is a lot of responsibilities on the backs of the people that work for adult probation and parole. They are the unsung heroes for sure. Today, Vaughn is going to come back, and we are going to talk about adult probation and parole, where Vaughn spent most of his career. Welcome back, Vaughn. This is your second appearance on the Gay Florida Man podcast, and we're glad to have you back.
Well, thank you for having me. It's the last time was quite the experience, so hopefully this one will be the same.
It was a lot of fun talking about different administrations, and as I watch the news there in Utah, I see that there are some struggles trying to get staff to work at the prison. They're paying $27.33 an hour to start at the prison. I have to ask if the reason that people don't want to work there, or if they have such a hard time, is because of the poor decisions from previous directors that we talked about in our last podcast.
You know, I think it's just come down to the law enforcement environment, just getting really hard to be a law enforcement officer or correction officer. There's a lots of work out here in Utah. They're bumping the pay up, but you're still making more being a street officer. You're getting $30 to $34 an hour to start as a police officer. So there's draw. So they've actually done a good job at raising the pay for police officers, and they've bumped up the pay, but it's just still not working for corrections. Now, just with the environment and job culture, it's really hard to get them work. And then the new prison, the new supervision model, is kind of pushed back also.
Is it true that Salt Lake County has now fallen behind corrections for starting pay for correctional officer?
Yep, for the first time, but that won't last for long. they'll probably raise it up as soon as they meet after the first of the year.
Keeping up with the Joneses.
Yeah.
What we're talking about today is, of course, when people think of the Utah Department of Corrections, they always think in terms of the prison. But that is only half of the bigger picture, because you have adult probation or parole that supervises people from the courts when they're put on probation, not sentenced to prison, and then those people that are released from prison out into the community. And that's what you primarily did for a lot of your career, but I know you started the prison.
I did a ton of time. I had only 2 years at the prison, but then when I went to APMP, I worked overtime out there because I enjoyed the people, and it was a good way to make some extra money.
Now, but you definitely had more satisfaction working out there in the field, though, I guess.
Yes. You had these cases where you'd watch someone come in and they're addicted, and you kind of pushed them into treatment and they kind of change your ways. They got off, and there's sometimes that I would see people out on the street and you're like, hey, this guy's still out. And they'd actually come up and say, hey, thanks for changing my life. It was quite rewarding when you'd see that. But then there's other times you see guys that you've sent back to jail because they didn't do very well. And you're like, oh, crap. am I going to get assaulted here? So, yeah, that was rewarding in two ways, because one, you help someone, and another ways you sent someone to prison that really didn't need to be out in society.
So for people that have never worked in law enforcement or corrections, a person commits a crime, they go through the whole legal process. Unfortunately, they end up in prison, but they put themselves there. They do their time in prison, then they come up for parole, and they have to fill out a parole agreement before they're going to be released. And they have to abide by certain requirements from the Board of Pardons in Utah. There are certain stipulations that you have to agree to depending on your crime. And so whether you have problems with substance abuse or education or housing, the parole agreement. Tell me more about that. If I'm in prison and I'm going to be getting this paperwork that I have to abide by before they're going to release me.
They have what they call special conditions and the standard parole agreement. So the standard parole agreement has, I think, 12 questions. So you have maintain a residence, not associate with known felons, maintain employment. Those are all the standard conditions. So anytime you violate that, they violate it. We send a report to the Board of Pardons. They have quite a few conditions for just standard conditions. So I can't remember all 12, but they're simple ones like everybody in the community does every day. So it just spells out, okay, this is what you have to do to be successful in life. And it's nothing that's crazy. And it's pretty easy to do if you just live your life. Then the special conditions are you have like substance abuse therapy, mental health therapy, get your GED, pay restitution, not associate with a certain person or a victim. They can actually add anything. One is like you cannot have a checking account if you're into financial crimes or a credit card. Or if you're a sex offender, you can't go to schools or parks. They can pretty much add whatever they want. And in order for you to get out, you have to agree to those conditions. And they're not crazy, so they will sign it because they know there's nothing really they can do to get around it. So they sign it and then they come out to AP&P and say, well, I really didn't like this condition, but I signed it anyway. And so now I have to say, okay, you don't like it, but you still have to abide by it. And so sometimes you get a little pushback because they didn't like, oh, I like to have a beer every once in a while. Well, you do substance abuse, so you can't have alcohol. That's what starts you down the road to using again. There's sometimes some pushback from them, and it's a struggle because they're an alcoholic and alcohol is legal for everybody to drink. Why can't they have a beer once in a while? So they justify it that way. It's kind of interesting to get inside their mind to see how they justify some of their behavior.
That's the angle they take so they can fulfill their need for substances.
Yep.
For people that are getting out of prison and they don't have a place to go, but they, of course, they're not going to give up the opportunity to get out of prison because that whole life kind of sucks for most people. But they get out, if they don't have a place to go to, a lot of times they'll be required to stabilize in a halfway house where they can get a job, save up the money, and then go out into the community and find a place to live that's been approved by adult probation and parole. For a short time in 2003, as you already know, Vaughn, I worked at Bonneville Halfway House. And I kind of got to learn the whole system of how guys get out of prison. They come to the halfway house and they've got to stabilize. They've got to spend a certain amount of time until they can get a residence that they are allowed to go live at that's been approved by AP&P. And they get a job, they save up the money, and then they have to pay a certain amount to the halfway house to basically offset the cost of living there. And it's a great program to help people stabilize. I've agreed with it very much. Then once you find a residence, AP&P approves it, and then you can go out and you can transition out there and start living your life. What is your thoughts on the halfway house system that Utah has?
I think it's great. They're looking to open more. I don't think they've done it. They're trying to put one down in southern Utah, but they've opened several in the last few years. Right now, they charge them $8 a day, and they get meals, showers. They'll have religious organizations come in and get them clothes, sometimes a bike if they can justify that they need transportation because they can't use public transportation for their work. And so they've got a lot of organizations that help with the halfway houses. So I think it's a great opportunity. There is one drawback is that they put them in these industrial areas. So sometimes it's hard for them to get around, but you don't want to put them next to a school or a residential area. You know, there are some drawbacks for them, but it's a great environment to let those individuals stabilize there's always problems with that, because then you get your gangs that kind of still go in there and cause problems within that halfway house. I think it's a great opportunity to get these guys out, who a lot of them have been in prison for years, and they don't know. When I started, they didn't know what computers were or cell phones, and so they're trying to figure out technology, and it's a great opportunity, and I think they'll continue to expand them as they get officers and go that route more than incarceration. Eventually, they would like to do that as probation, use it for probationers, but they don't have the resources or the places facilities. To put those halfway houses. Yeah, the facilities.
So, you know, one thing that's great, they do put a lot of these places in industrial areas, is a lot of times the jobs that they're eligible to work, a lot of them can't work in places. I had one guy that I supervised, and he wanted to go work at Guitar World. And of course, my supervisor, Bradley Bassey, he just kind of laughed and was like, "You're a fucking idiot. You're not going to go work at Guitar World. You've actually got to go out there and earn an income." And, "Well, I want to learn how to play the guitar." "Well, you're not working at Guitar World. You can do that when you're done with this whole program." But the industrial areas offered a lot of jobs, usually, that these guys could get approved to go work. It wasn't going to be like a fast food restaurant or like a mall or someplace where AP&P was not going to approve them to work. Industrial areas actually opened up certain opportunities for them to do manufacturing type labor.
A lot of them do that type of labor, that and construction. It does provide those opportunities. It's the transportation and sometimes if they have skills to get out in the community. That's the only barrier that I see those for those halfway houses.
You know, I only worked at the halfway house for like a year, and I was not a fan of the setup, and it wasn't so much, the job itself was great. There was definitely more freedoms, but I didn't like the fact that on certain days, a lot of people would have off, and on the weekend, I remember this one particular individual felt like he was suicidal, and he went outside and he climbed like an antenna tower, and he was going to jump, and the inmates run in and say, "Hey, Bob has climbed up the tower. He's going to jump." And I run out there and I'm like, "Bob, don't fucking jump, please. It's just me and one other guy working today." And we had to actually call Salt Lake City to come and back us up to get the guy down and talk him down and de-escalate the situation. And whereas I'm so used to working at the prison where you call for help, like 15 people respond. And that was great. The halfway house was a whole different animal that I was not used to. I also didn't like getting phone calls on my days off saying, "Hey, did you say this guy could go out to this work search?" Or, "Hey, did you know about this guy?" And this, all these different phone calls I was getting that I wasn't getting compensated for. And I ended up with a shift that was like an 8-hour shift, 5 days a week, where when I worked at the prison, it was 12 hours, 7 days and a 2-week period. So I was driving a lot more. And so I said, "This isn't my gig." So I gave it up and went back to the prison and finished out my career. But I think the halfway house is a great job. And if somebody wants to become an agent, hopping over to the halfway house and going out to adult probation parole, that's a great segue into becoming an agent. So you start to learn the ins and outs of that job.
Yes, so I had that same experience with the cell phone. So as an agent, you were on basically on call 24/7 because you'd have someone call you up at 10 o'clock at night, say, "Hey, I had a buddy come over and he brought some dope and I'm sitting here in front of it. And tell me why I shouldn't use it." Sometimes I'd take the calls if I wasn't doing anything. Other times I'd just let it go to voicemail. But sometimes if you have the time, you take the call and say, talk the person down, and you spend 5 minutes with the person and it saves you 4 hours worth of work because now they're in their addiction and you have to go find them. And there's drawbacks depending on what I was doing. If I wasn't doing anything, I'd take the call, and you don't get compensated. But the way I looked at it is if I can spend 5 minutes talking some guy off the ledge, then it saves me 4 hours down the line. And there are some people that says, "No matter what, I'm not answering my phone."
That's me. And
and my kids would hear me talking to these people and they'd say, you know, sometimes I'd get after them and other times they're like, "Holy cow, Dad, you're basically a caseworker or a therapist trying to work with these people." So you, as an agent, you're pretty much a police officer, a caseworker, an employment specialist. You just have to learn to put on several different hats to help these individuals. And the last hat I like to do is put the law enforcement hat on, because I'd rather work with people and help them, because they, eventually they're going to be in the community. Sometimes that law enforcement hat had to come on.
You've got the perfect personality to work adult probation and parole because of wearing the different hats and all the responsibilities you have. Is it safe to say that when you work adult probation and parole, you have to have a certain higher level of commitment to your job than working at the prison?
Yeah. And so when I first started, I had the prison mentality that I'm the big dog on the block and, you know, you kind of kept everybody in line. And then as you learn the job, you learn that you have to put these different hats in order to make your job easier and then also to help other people. So a lot of people have that conversion within about a year or two. So you don't actually learn how to do the job for about 2 years, because there's so many moving parts that you have to work with therapists and the Board of Pardons or the courts and law enforcement. It's a huge learning curve that you just can't come in and be successful right off the bat. You've got to learn a lot of the skills, which is hard to teach. People have to learn them as you run into situations.
Flexibility is the name of the game.
You have to be flexible. That's true.
And there's so many different personality types too, that I'm sure you work with, not just with the offenders, not with the guys getting out of prison, but just all the other personalities. I'm sure you probably have some stories with some of the people that you've worked with through the years where you had to roll your eyes and you really had to grin and bear it with certain supervisors you probably had.
I had supervisors that were very strict and they wanted everything tight. And then I had other supervisors. They didn't even care if you did anything. Just come into work, show up, and then when you get your 40 hours, leave. So I actually enjoyed the ones that were strict, because they taught me to learn to do the job well and not take it home with you. The lax ones, you didn't learn anything from. So I was all about learning. So I actually liked the supervisors that were more strict. And they had a bad name, but they were my favorite supervisors.
I think that in the long term, the strict ones are going to protect you from
exactly
getting thrown under the bus. Because imagine yourself, for people listening to this, imagine you're an agent and you supervise, you know, a caseload of 75 to 150 offenders. Somebody that you supervise gets on the news for doing something extremely violent. The first thing that they're going to look at adult probation and parole, because they got to cover their ass, is what type of level of supervision this guy's had, how often he's checked in, is the agent staying on top of this guy, are all the ducks in the row, or is there documentation of when he checked in, when he's drug tested, et cetera, right?
That's right. So they have three levels. Actually, they have four. Intense, very few offenders were in the intense supervision, but the low supervision is someone they don't have a very long criminal history. They pretty much will make it off probation with very little effort. They're motivated. It's kind of like the first time DUI guy that went to the bar and had too much and got a DUI. So that's kind of your low type offender. And then you have your moderates. Those are your low level drug users. They steal a little bit to support their habit. And with a little intervention, they'll, you know, be able to be successful and get off probation. Then your highs are your robbers, your murders, your gang members and stuff like that, where it's going to take a lot of work and supervision. And your intents are ones that have been locked up and they've got some real mental health issues and antisocial. And I think I only had like three of them my whole 15 years that came out as an intense. And I did parole for 15 of my 18 years in AP&P. So I was always doing the high-risk offenders because I'd rather deal with them than the low levels. So if you're low level, you have to see them once every 90 days. Doesn't matter if it's in the office or at the home. So you don't have to see them very often. Your moderates, once in the office a month, and in the field, which is you go out to their house and you see them once every 90 days in the field. And then your highs are once in the office and once in the field. And your intents are every 2 weeks in the office and every week you have to see them in the field. when you get in someone that's intense, it's time consuming. There's a lot of criteria to push them up into that intense range.
I know we talked about these levels of supervision, low, moderate, high, intense. Is that correct? Those are the four?
Yeah.
And so I know that we had talked about the assessment that is done before they are released from prison, where you will evaluate what level of supervision these people need. And I remember you had told me at one time what that process was and how they're assessed.
What it's called is an LSI, a level of risk inventory.
Okay.
And it's about 100, maybe 120 questions that you go through and you ask about family situation, abuse. Did they have family members that's incarcerated, or what their job history is like? It's just every type of background question you can think of, and you get a point. It's been so long since I've done one, I can't remember the cutoff points for the levels. Mm-hmm. Once you started getting so many points, that's when it would tell you. And it would tell you, like, they have a hard time with impulse control because they have a lot of leisure time. So you need to figure out how to give them something to do or find a job that takes up a lot of time. And so they don't have that leisure, recreational, extra time. Or if they have a criminal history, you need to get them into some criminal thinking classes. So it will break it down into areas with these 100 questions or so, and tell you what their risk factors are. And it comes up with, I think, about 10 different risk factors that rates them from high to low in that assessment. It kind of gives you a snapshot of what you need to do to help them work on their life. So it's a great tool. And then the department decided, well, we're going to give you this, what we call a suitcase. And now you're going to have to, whenever you meet with them, you're going to have these life interviews. When you're dealing with parolees that are been locked up for 5 years and or they are antisocial and they don't like talking to you, only reason they come in to talk to you is to get a drug test and say, yeah, you're doing good, keep it up. And they're happy with that. So then the legislature, the department says, oh, this is going to be great, you know, and we're like, no, it's not going to work. And so they started forcing us to do all these things. And we're like, no, it's not going to work. Trust us. And they shoving it down our throat and we're like, trust us, we know how to talk to these people. And the more interaction you have with them, it's going to just piss them off. And I think eventually they still say that you should do it, but now it's not a mandate. They would have you do these interviews.
It's recommended.
Like, yeah, it's recommended. But before it was mandated that you had to do these interviews, and everybody's like, they hate it, we hate it, it's just causing friction in our appointments. So they finally just said, okay, we'll recommend it. But that's something that you could see that the legislature and the admin think they know better, and they don't even consult the officers. And you're like, where did you come up with this? This is like a pipe dream. It's never going to work.
That seems to happen in every department in the world. Some administrator gets an idea and they're going to go with it. And they're not going to get the feedback from the staff. They're going to say, we're doing it. And if you don't like it, you can resign. And it sucks. It really sucks. So APMP does the LSI, Vaughn. How far before, or how soon before a person is released from prison, is the LSI done when they evaluate all the risk factors and where they score on how they should be supervised?
So actually they do it at sentencing when they do it. So when they go, before they get sent to prison, they do it in the pre-sentence report. That's the report that the judge requests to kind of give a snapshot of their life and their criminal history. And so they do it there. APMP recommends how much time they do and kind of their risk factor. So they do it prior to sentencing. So if they get sent to prison, they already have one done. The Board of Pardons uses it for, okay, while he's locked up, we're going to recommend that he does substance use treatment, anger management classes out at the prison, you know, just whatever classes are available out there. They'll make recommendations in there. I can't remember what they call it, but they had a case action plan. Is that what you guys, did they have out at the prison?
Or management action plan, a mapping.
Yeah, mapping, yeah. So that's where that came from, is they did that LSI prior to sentencing. And so about 90 days before they get out of prison, a caseworker will do it. Or if they don't get it done as soon as they're released from prison, APMP will redo that assessment to see if anything's changed which most of the times it'll change it maybe by a point or two because nothing's really changed in their life. Sometimes they do it at the prison or they wait for us to do it because there's really not a change in the point structure.
What's the recidivism rate for people that parole out of the prison in Utah?
80% return back to the prison at least once.
Really? So I did not 80, know it was that high.
Yeah.
80%.
Because they get out and they'll go right back to their old friends, the NL or their gang members, or it's a huge recidivism rate. If they do it, they'll go back and then they'll do like, you know, 90 days on a, if it's just simple violations, and then they'll come out and we're like, okay, you've had your, you know, you saw how it works. Now let's get down to business and not go back. And so your second time around is where you, if they are motivated, that's where you'll get the change and you'll have more success. You have offenders that go in and out for life. They'll just go out, do their time, come out, do parole 2-3 times, and then they'll terminate their sentence, which means they, you know, maximum benefit, they'll do like 18 months and then get released on expiration of sentence, or the board will just cut them loose saying, hey, this is maximum benefit, we're going to kick you back out on the street, which I don't agree with, but you know, you can only go back and forth so many times. And so then they'll go out and commit a new crime and get sent back to prison. And they're called the lifers, that you just know that you just got to watch them close. They're just going to be in and out, and you're going to just fight the board and fight with them, trying to convince them to change their life. And for men, they do it about 40 years old. Their body starts to break down and they lose their sex appeal with the meth whores and, you know.
I'm 51, Vaughn. You're hitting close to home now. Are we just talking offenders, or what are we talking? You said, you know, when
people start hitting 40. You know.
Okay. If we worked in law enforcement, we never break down. We're Superman, right?
Yeah, that's right. Women are different. If they get pregnant, they bond with the child. They'll change their life. But if not, then when they hit about 30 to 35, they'll see that their kids are now starting to have kids and they're like, okay, I need to change my life for my grandkids, or I'm not going to be around for them. So the women's age is a little earlier. They actually, if they have kids when they're on probation, it tends to force them to change their lives a little sooner than the men. Men is a 40 is kind of the magic age that I observed. It's not true for everything, but it's a pretty good guideline. If you have your career criminals, that's when they're going to start to say, this isn't worth it anymore. And so women, children, and family is what kind of changes them. But if they lose their kids, they'll go until they're like mid-30s, their kids will start having it. And then they'll have a realization and say, I need to change my life.
Interesting. Who is the most challenging offender? I know you've already said that men have a tendency to be more high risk, whereas women, and you just explained, they'll kind of time out earlier. As far as supervising in the field, who is the most challenging, or just, I'm going to say it, shittiest person to supervise? Because you've got drug addicts, you've got sex offenders, you've got white collar criminals, blue collar criminals. Who's the worst? Who is the one that where it's like, this person is high risk and it's just a matter of time before they stop checking in and they take off?
Domestic violence and alcoholics, like your severe alcoholics, those are the hardest, because the alcoholics can get good at hiding and not answering doors. But domestic violence, in my opinion, are the worst, because they have an entitlement, like ownership of the woman, or they a property type mentality. That's my property type thing. And it can turn violent really easy with those guys, with their spouses. So those are the hardest ones. You don't get very many of them. With domestic violence, you always have child support. And so those two, with child support and domestic violence, because they always have kids involved, those are the hardest ones. And in my opinion, the ones that are most likely to have really bad consequences if they go off, because they'll end up killing themselves and their spouse, or just their spouse. But you have to watch those guys close.
Is their level of supervision usually intense right when they get out?
No, they're usually moderate, and because they don't have the background of drug abuse. They do usually have the alcohol abuse, but They usually come out as moderates, but they actually are harder to supervise. I actually override them to a high for at least the first 3 months just to get a feel for how they are. I'll do a manual override and get a supervisor to let me override them to a high. Mm. And most of the time they would, all of those that override them to a high just to get them to see if they are going to violate. But those guys are dangerous. Mm. I actually had one guy, once he got off parole or probation, he killed his wife and then he killed himself. So I was like, this guy's not going to make it. He jumped all through the hoops. And about a year after he got off probation, he ended up shooting his wife in Holiday and shooting himself.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was. And you could see it. He's like, I told my supervisor, I don't want to put him in for termination, but I have to because he's come up to his 3 years. He's going to kill this lady. And he eventually did. But there was nothing we could do to stop it. Those, in my opinion, that and your DUIs, because they, you know, that their drug is legal. So they justify, hey, everybody else can drink. I'm going to drink.
Well, and alcohol is so accessible. It's everywhere. When I worked at AP&P at the halfway house, I know that traditionally home visits were done. Well, they could be done at any time, but I know the agents would go out in the field on Thursdays. This is dated material because it's been close to 20 years since I was working AP&P. But is that still the case where they have certain kind of like nights that AP&P goes out and they do random checks on the people that they supervise?
Yeah, they do. I think it was 80% of your visits after 5 o'clock. Which you had some agents that never went out at night and always went out during the day. And then you had people that would go out half the time at night and half the time during the day. But I always looked at it, you know, you do your afternoon visits on people, you know, that are trying to avoid work. And then most of the time, the rest of your visits are at night because that's when you'll catch them home. And that's when you'll catch them making mistakes or, you know, you can have some good talks with family because if they're living with family, you're like, you could get a feel like, oh, how's Johnny doing? Is he coming home on time? And they'll shake their head and say no, but they'll say yes. So they'll give you indications, you know, body language you'll pick up on is, you know, they'll be shaking their head no and say, yeah, he's coming home all when he should be. So then you can kind of pick up, like, I need to watch this guy a little bit more.
You know, the terminology, and I see the differences because you worked adult probation parole. I worked at the prison, and I love the way that you use the term, this is when you'll find them making mistakes, whereas I would have said, this is where you find them fucking up. I love that you're very eloquent with your speech, and you're very articulate, and I have a tendency to be right to the point, very blunt and abrasive. And I just think that's the differences between your position and mine.
Well, yeah, you have those times when F words are, you know, you drop the F bomb and that's the only thing that they understand is like,
sure,
put your fucking hands up, you know? And then you have the times when you're like, hey grandma, how you doing? You know, is he helping you out around the house? So you have to kind of have those both types of vocabulary readily available to communicate because they still have that prison mentality when they get out. You have to learn how to use your expletives a little bit wiser.
Of course. There's a pucker factor that happens in any type of corrections. And in the prison, you know, you walk up on a cell and a guy is hanging, then you get this pucker factor that you have to act immediately. In adult probation parole, I can't imagine how many times you had that pucker factor where your life was at risk or things were about to go down. What is the one time that you remember an incident where you said, oh shit, this is really bad?
So on field visit, you're supposed to go out with your supervisor at least once a quarter. And I thought, okay, I'm going to take her over to one of my white supremacist guys. That's a lieutenant in the Aryan gang, which is SAW, which is Southern Aryan Warriors. I told her prior to going in, it's an apartment up on the second level, and we're going to walk in. And, you know, you never know with these guys what you're going to run into, but he's been pretty respectful every time I come over. It shouldn't be a big deal.
What time of day is this when you're going to his place?
So it was about 7 o'clock at night. So it was dark. It was like spring or fall because I remember walking up and it was dark outside. It was probably around 7 o'clock. So we knock on the door all of a sudden the door opens and there's five Aryan Brotherhood guys in there. And I could tell who they were because they had tattoos and I'm like, oh crap, this is not good. So I requested backup right as soon as we started to walk in, because I'm like, this could go sideways so easy. There was five of them, and then as you push the door open, there's a chair behind, and there's a Hispanic guy sitting in a chair. He had like a handle of a dagger underneath his leg, and I'm like, oh crap. But there was two guys that were giving me the mad dog eye. They were like eyeing me down, the young guys of the gang. I told my supervisor, put those two in cuffs. I'm going to deal with this guy over here. So as soon as she got those two guys in cuffs, which she only had two sets of cuffs, that was a problem. And then I always carried two sets of cuffs. So we had four guys in cuffs. We could only put four guys in cuffs, and we had six people. So while this is all happening, while we're waiting for backup, so I stand the Hispanic guy up, and underneath him, he has the dagger. So I grabbed that, and then a pound of weed was under him. I left that there, put him in cuffs, and then the lieutenant, I purposely did not put him in cuffs, because if I can keep him calm, everybody else would stay calm. And he knew he was going to jail because of his association and the drugs I found. And so I gave him respect. So I think because of that, he didn't cause a ruckus and have the other guys get riled up and make it so he could get out of there. So that was one of those situations that you're like, holy cow, this could be a nightmare. But after we got backup, we found a girlfriend and another guy in the back room. And so we had a whole house full of people in this two-bedroom apartment. Of that, we had four people out of the six, I guess, went to jail or to put back to prison off of that. That just kind of shows you have to learn who you're dealing with in order to not escalate the situation.
How long did this guy go back to prison for? What would people expect as far as this level of violation? How long before he's back out on the street?
Because it was just a simple association and a drug like marijuana, he was out within, I think, 90 to 180 days. So it wasn't long, because that's the only violations we had with him. But because of the severity of the association, he had a no gang cause down there, so he couldn't associate with gang members. And so he didn't go back long, but it was enough to put him back and reset him. I don't remember whatever happened to him, but I never had a run-in with him. And he's one that if I'd see him on the street, I probably wouldn't worry too much about him, because we kind of had that understanding that I'm doing my job, he was doing his thing, and it wasn't the fact that I was out to get him. It was like, hey, I'm just doing a job. So there's two or three people that if I saw on the street, I know I'd be in trouble, because it would be game on. Just from doing this for so long.
Even now?
Oh, yeah. They, as ATMP or law enforcement, so you get to do the federal law enforcement carry. So you just have to go in and get certified every year. So I'll carry my weapon with me, most of the time, probably for a couple more years until I put them away for 10 plus a couple of the guys for 10 plus years for weapons violation, or one guy put away for mortgage fraud, and it was his third time. And so he's one that I would be like, if I saw him, he'd come after me.
Wow.
So I do that for my protection of myself and my family.
Well, I hope he's taking anger management while he's there.
Exactly.
We have talked about supervision standards when you are working for APMP and you have to see these people, and people don't realize how much paperwork is involved, how much notes you have to put in on tracking all of your people. And we've talked about in the past, you and I have talked about caseloads, and you work for adult probation and parole. There are different levels of caseloads depending on your level of supervision. So I was wondering if there was a way for you to simplify that on somebody that works for APMP, what they can expect to how many people they've got to supervise on their caseload.
So probation is probably the hardest caseload to work, which is because you will have influxes of cases all the time because you have so many judges and it's statewide. So if someone decides to move from Provo to Salt Lake, then they transfer it up here. So your caseloads on probation tend to be more from the 80s to the 120 range. If you're a probation agent, you can just expect that you're going to have to work hard to keep it at 80. When I did probation, my numbers were at 70, and that's where I found that if you have 70 cases, it's manageable, but you're going to be busy. Anything over 70, and you're going to be just putting out fires. So that's through my experiences where I would try to keep my number is at 70. Then you would have your parole cases, which are usually lower. You'd have them between 50 to 70. They tried to limit those, but at times you'd have overcrowding, and the Board of Pardons would do, they would say, okay, these guys are drug offenders. We're going to release them early. You know, we can manage them in the community just as well. And you'd get a parole caseload sometimes around 80. A parole caseload, if you get above 60, you're just putting out fires because you can't supervise those high risks efficiently when you get above 60. And then you'll have your sex offenders, which they try to keep at 40, and they pretty much keep them at 40, your sex offender caseloads. Women's are about the same, whether you're on probation or parole, the women and men. You won't have a mixed caseload if you're in Salt Lake County, but if you're in the smaller areas, like the rural areas, you'll have a mixture of sex offender, women, parole, probation. But in Salt Lake County, which is one of the biggest counties in Utah, you would have a specialized caseload. And it actually made it a lot easier having those specialized caseloads.
Now, I worked with somebody that had worked at the prison for several years, and then she made the jump, went out to adult probation and parole, and she was an agent. She had her bachelor's degree. She went out there and she did that. But she came back to the prison because she was talking about the expectations of APMP, and you've got this laptop that you can take home, and you've got to put in notes constantly on these guys that you supervise. And she said it was impossible to stay current with the expectations unless she worked at home, which you're not compensated for. And she grew frustrated because she went to him and she's like, okay, how do I do this? And they're like, oh, well, you have a laptop. Okay, if I bring the laptop home and I'm doing notes on all these guys, how do I put that on my timesheet? Oh, you don't. Well, okay, but then if I don't work from home for free, then I'm not going to stay current with my caseload. And they're like, well, you know, you got to do what you got to do, you know, do the best you can. But that's not good enough because I'm not going to stay current with my caseload. And there was just kind of an understanding that a lot of agents, because they get so involved with the job and to stay current, stay within standard, they have to work from home or in their downtime when they're not on the clock to stay current. Was that the case that you saw when you worked there?
You know, it was for a little bit, but I found workarounds. And then I finally said, this is a job. This isn't my life. Because it was taken away from family. Mm-hmm. So I would just basically do what I was saying before, you're just putting out fires. You're just constantly doing reports to the court or to the board and just putting out fires because the department wasn't covering your back by saying, oh, we got your caseload's too high. We need to, you know, hire more people. They were just like, nope, you got to do what you got to do. So I said, no, I'm not going to do that. And then I just had young kids. So I would go out, I'd work overtime at the prison, and that's where I would do all my extra entries. As a lot of guys, so I would say, hey, I'd go out to the prison and talk to the sergeant, say, I'm willing to do whatever you want, but I'm not going to just sit here and do nothing. If I could just get on the computer, I'm going to just work, put some notes in my people's file. And, you know, when you need me to do something, just tell me what you want me to do. So I was pretty good with communicating with the sergeants on duty that, hey, I'll work the blocks, I'll do checks, you just tell me what to do, and if not, I'll just be sitting in front of this computer putting my notes in. So that was one workaround I did, and that made it so that I could get my numbers down. So when I started having my numbers go up and I needed to put in or do like a termination report to get them off of probation or parole, I'd do it out at the prison because I would have extra time, and I'd work a graveyard shift so that there was not much that you had to do. So I could just do 8 hours of just case notes or a termination request. So there's workarounds as an agent. You figure out how to do that and get paid for it.
I remember you working graveyard shifts at the prison, and I'm glad that you didn't do a whole lot on my shift because we would ended up spending the whole night laughing and, you know, watching YouTube videos or inappropriate things. And you wouldn't have gotten your caseload up to date with APMP if we'd been working together.
Yeah, we did have some fun. I remember going out at the prison. You know, we had some good storytelling times.
Sure.
That was one of the reasons I went out there. The money was nice, but getting my caseload caught up was one of the main reasons I did overtime.
When I worked at Bonneville, again, I was only there for a year, and so I had very limited number of stories. But one of the stories that I did have was I actually had a sex offender on my – I only had a caseload of like 15 guys when I was there as a shift leader. And so this guy, his name was Brian. He was a sex offender, and he was like your classic pedophile. I think he had completed sex offender treatment at the prison, and he'd come out. They wanted him to continue with it. And so he was out doing work search, and then before he could actually be released from the halfway house, he had to pass a polygraph. And I will never forget this one. The polygraph examiner, it was a female polygraph examiner, she came in and she's like, look, Mark, this guy failed the polygraph. And he admitted to like 50 or 100 unnamed victims. And he liked boys. He liked teenage boys. He admitted to 50 or 100 undeclared victims, and he still failed. And I think she had said like at a level 12. I'm not very versed with polygraph standards, but I know she said that if he has killed somebody, it wouldn't surprise her, because even admitting to all those additional victims, he still failed miserably. So he's still very deceptive. But he also admitted hiding pornography out in the community and going out and finding these magazines and masturbating. And he had gone down to Exchange Place in Salt Lake City because he'd heard there was young male prostitutes that hanged out at Exchange Place. So he went down there and he was so aroused, he had to go into a restaurant, into the bathroom to masturbate. You know, we violated him. We sent him back to prison. But again, they don't stay there forever. Eventually they'll get out in the community. It was several years later, I saw him working at a fast food restaurant up in Layton, Utah. That's Brian. I can't believe he's out, but it had been several years. Corrections can't hold him forever because you reach the end of your sentence, whether you expirate, terminate, whatever, they can't keep them forever. And they're still going to be out in the community.
It's hard. So that you have to do whatever you can in the time that their sentence allows. And sometimes you don't get any benefit and you just have to let them out. It's sometimes difficult to see that happen.
As you look back at your career, Vaughn, what's the most satisfying aspect of your career with APMP?
Actually seeing the people that I helped out in the community and having them come up and saying, you know what, thanks for helping me change my life. I have struggles once in a while, but you gave me the tools to make it in society. Those are the best. That's when I miss the job, is when I do that, when I run into people. That's one aspect I miss of the job, is just actually helping people or sending them back to protect society. That's kind of how I looked at it. And so I can go to bed at night knowing that, you know, I did my best trying to help people. And that's what I got out of the job. It was, for me, it was more than a job. It was kind of, I'm there to provide a service, and it's people's lives.
Anything you would change if you could go back and do it again?
Yeah, probably wouldn't have been the union president for as long as I was.
Really?
I enjoyed it. But just because it kind of hindered my career a little bit. I probably could have moved up faster and maybe gone one more level if I wasn't. But I did enjoy it because I was helping officers protect them when they'd make stupid decisions, or if the department was trying to shaft them, and I was helping them keep their job. But that kind of wore on me a little bit near the end. I was like, I should have stopped about 2 years earlier being the president. So administrations will change. So you'll have different policies. So that I knew that was going to change through the years I was doing it. So you just kind of work with administration because they weren't going to be in there forever. They usually had a 2 to 5 year shelf life. So things would change every 2 to 5 years.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting perspective. You caught me off guard with that response, because when I look back, and the one thing I was most pleased with my career was getting involved with the unions and fighting for staff, even though I only made it to sergeant and people said, you really need to test for lieutenant. You need to continue to go up the chain, but then I'll become part of management and it will be harder for me to fight for staff. And so for me, my most satisfying part was becoming very heavily involved with the union.
I enjoyed it, but it did wear on me because you'd see the mistakes or the admin going after people. So that was the only thing that really kind of tore me down a little bit and made me not enjoy work a little bit, is when I would have to deal with those situations. But I enjoyed it. At the end, that was starting to wear on me the most.
Very, very cool. Is there anything else you wanted to sum up about adult probation and parole before we call this the end of our episode?
You know, I always have good stories, but I think that we covered everything pretty well about APNP. I think we're good.
For people that are listening, if you have any questions for myself or Vaughn, you can always contact me through the Gay Florida Man Facebook page. You can message me, or through Instagram, the Gay Florida Man Instagram page, or of course, Twitter. If you have questions or comments, please send them my way, and I will, of course, forward them to Vaughn. Vaughn, thanks so much for coming back on the podcast. I loved our last episode, and I love this episode.
Well, thank you, Mark. It was enjoyable.
And I'm going to tell everybody the same thing I tell you every week, and that is to be good. And if you can't be good at it. And if you're sitting in prison, you're not good at it. Good night, everybody.